Welcome to City Club of Eugene's March 8th, 2019 program. It's time for campaign finance reform. This is the 23rd program for 2018-2019 programming year. I am Joel Corin, City Club President. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member at cityclubofeugene.org. Our diamond sponsors are Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care services to improve the health of our members and communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. And the University of Oregon. Since 1876, the UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. And Peace Health. Our mission is our shared purpose since we were founded more than 125 years ago to promote personal and community wellness, to relieve pain and suffering, to treat each person as a loving and caring way. For more, visit peacehealth.org. And our Sapphire sponsor, Johnson, Johnson, Lucas, and Middleton. Support for City Club comes from the law offices of Johnson, Johnson, Lucas, and Middleton, whose mission is to obtain justice and fair compensation for people who have been harmed because of someone else's wrongful conduct. More information at justicelawyers.com. Our coordinator for today's program is Mary Layton, who will introduce the speakers.
Hi. Public opinion surveys show strong bipartisan support for campaign finance reform. Last year, our family got up close and personal experience of why this must happen. My highly qualified, hardworking son decided to run for elective office, and every person in the family got to open their wallet. Further, he spent hours every day making calls and pitching his candidacy to potential donors, in addition to the daily hours he spent with other voters, learning their concerns. Had he not been a lawyer married to a doctor with both vast acquaintance among folks who could contribute and a schedule that accommodated such disruption, he would not have been elected. While we are all grateful that he was, and he's doing a great job, we are conscious that privilege pays too big a role in these matters. And we know even bigger donors expect to call some shots on legislation. This is not good for the democratic process, in my view. This panel will discuss two types of public funding for elections: small donor matching and donor vouchers, also called democracy vouchers. Charlie Fisher is the executive director of OSPERG, a consumer advocacy group with the mission of protecting voters' rights to participate in democratic decision-making. He will summarize the findings in a recent OSPERG report on big money in Oregon state elections. David Schumann served as a judge on the Oregon Court of Appeals for 9 years before returning to UO Law School, where he teaches constitutional law. He will describe the constitutional issues around campaign financing and some of the bills now before the Oregon legislature. Kristen Eberhard is a researcher, writer, speaker, lawyer, and policy analyst who leads Sightline Institute's work on democracy reform. She is a leading expert on electoral reform in the Pacific Northwest. She will explain what Seattle and Portland have been doing to integrate public financing into elections. Robin Quirk is a researcher at Policy Interactive. Her focus is on learning to understand general public opinions data that while testing policy possibilities. She will share Pacific Northwest public opinion data that show extremely strong bipartisan support for campaign finance reform among voters. And thanks to Robin, who organized this panel. First, we'll listen to Charlie.
Thanks, Mary, and thanks for having me. Again, my name is Charlie Fisher. I'm the state director of OSPERG. State director of OSPERG, as a citizen-based public interest organization focused on standing up to powerful special interests. It's no surprise that money in politics and campaign finance reform are big issues for us. And I think the place to start here is just to point out that Oregon is somewhat unique when it comes to campaign finance. And in this case, while Oregon is unique in very many positive ways, I don't think that's the case here. We're one of five states in the country with absolutely no limits on campaign contributions. And I think that manifested itself quite clearly in the most recent gubernatorial race, where one candidate received $2.5 million from a single individual, and both received dozens of six-figure contributions from special interests, from individuals and organizations to influence who ultimately won the race. So that's the really 3,000-foot level view. But what we wanted to do in our research, Big Money in Oregon State Elections, was dig a little bit further into this issue and really find out what the disparity is between large donors in Oregon elections and small donors, and what that means for candidates, both in terms of who runs in the first place, and once they make the decision to run, how it influences how they run their campaign. So for the purposes of this study, which looked at campaign finance data from 2016 in Oregon, so looking at candidate races, both legislative and statewide, as well as ballot measures, we define large donor as someone who gave $5,000 or more, and small donor as someone who gave $250 or less. And I think the findings are shouldn't be too much of a surprise, but they really do illuminate just the vast disparity that we're talking about. So in 2016, for candidate races, that's state legislative races, statewide races like governor's race, secretary of state, et cetera, there were 424 large donors who collectively gave nearly $9 million for an average of about $21,000 per person. In contrast, there were 29,000 small donors, so regular folks from around the state who gave a small amount of their hard-earned money to a candidate that they supported, who collectively gave about $2.4 million. So those just over 400 wealthy donors and special interests outspent everyone else nearly 4-to-1. So you can, those numbers kind of speak for themselves. But a couple other interesting pieces here. When you add ballot measure campaigns into this the disparity is even more stark. In 2016, including candidate races and ballot measures, there were 723 large donors who outspent all small donors 14-to-1. one additional piece here. While, again, unsurprisingly, large donors dominate regardless of the situation, when you look at the difference between donor money coming from out of state and donor money coming from in state, about 80% of all of the money contributed to campaigns from out of Oregon were from these large donors. And 60% of money from in-state donors came from large, wealthy donors and special interests. So it's interesting to see that, especially when we're thinking about the influence not only of big money, but big money from out of state, overwhelmingly, when you're thinking about out-of-state donors, it's wealthy donors, special interests who want to influence the politics in Oregon without even living here. So, you can understand how this would influence both donor behavior and candidate behavior. From the candidate's perspective, it's no surprise that they're going to choose the most efficient way to raise the money they need to win a campaign. And so if you have the decision to raise $10,000 each from a couple donors or $10 from thousands of donors, it just makes rational sense from the perspective of a candidate that they would choose the former. But really what this means is, there's this thing called the money primary that people talk about. And what that means is before we even get our ballots, there's this primary to decide who runs in the first place. And that's based on whether or not you have access to wealth. So a candidate who has connections in their community and good ideas but doesn't have access to big donors oftentimes just simply makes the, again, rational decision not to run in the first place because they don't think that they can compete monetarily with well-financed big money candidates. So in our study, we in addition to looking at the numbers, we wanted to see actually from former candidates, both successful and unsuccessful, and prospective candidates, to find out how this system influences their decision making when it comes to whether to run in the first place, and then once they decide to run, how their campaign is influenced by the role of big money. So we interviewed a number of folks who, again, had run before or who were thinking about running to get that a sense of that. One of the people we interviewed, his name was Ozzy Gonzalez, who had lives in Portland. He considered running for multiple offices, most recently the Metro Council in Portland. He had been recruited, though, to state legislative races by current legislators, so, someone who really had good connections to his community and would have been a viable candidate. What he said was, the first thing you need to do is start a PAC. You've got to get a good fundraising agency. It shifted my perspective so quickly when I realized you have to set up a PAC, a fundraising mechanism, find fundraising partners, and you've got to quit your job to focus on reaching out to the key donors that are going to get your political campaign off the ground. It dissuaded me altogether. So that's a perfect example of the money primary. People who may have good ideas simply deciding not to run in the first place because of the money involved in running and who they have to fundraise from. Jamila Singleton, also in Portland, she actually ran a successful campaign for city council, school board in Portland, which surprisingly is becoming a more and more expensive race in recent years. She said, the fundraising part was really challenging. I probably spent only 5% of my time canvassing compared to 80% of my time fundraising. And then Tui Tran, a candidate who actually ran for House District 47 in East Portland, ultimately unsuccessful, said, our community in East Portland is very diverse with a lot of immigrants and refugees, and many are wary of the government, so asking money is very hard there. Sometimes people do give you what they can, and sometimes it's $10 or $20. Very few give you $1,000. So that should give you a sense of the perspective of people who have actually been there and thought about running or actually ran on how this disparity between big money and small money influences our political process. Now, and I know Kristen will talk more about the specifics of the potential policy options to address this problem, but in our study we looked at one and what the impact that would have on the 2016 election if there was public financing in place. So specifically, we looked at a matching system that matches small donors 6-1. And what we found was those small donors who previously were outspent, nearly 4-1, and spent about $2.4 million, they would have accounted for $12.5 million, and in fact, outspent large donors by 1.5. So to conclude, it's interesting because we look at this issue of campaign finance and think of it as a quite intractable problem, but in fact there are solutions and policies available, and I'm excited to be here to be part of the conversation to talk about them. So with that, I'll invite David up.
Well, thank you all for showing up and inviting me to this forum. While the speakers after me are talking, I'm going to log on to the City Club website and join. I've not joined in the past because for 17 years I commuted to Salem and I was just not here for the meetings. Okay, I actually have some personal experience with campaign financing. Well, what many of you probably already know is that judicial elections in Oregon have money-raising issues. Fortunately for candidates, the candidate, him or herself, can't participate in asking people for money, so I was relieved of that onerous duty, which for many people would have been a huge disincentive. My fundraiser raised $250,000 in 5 weeks. I have to say that a couple of my contributions were from big donors from out of state. In fact, the Oregonian checked out the contribution expenditure forms and ran a story about how One of my big donors was an out-of-state lawyer, and another one was an out-of-state banker. What it didn't tell you was that the out-of-state lawyer was my father, and the out-of-state banker was my brother-in-law. Any conversation about the constitutionality revolving around campaign finance reform has to begin with the very controversial and, in my opinion, tragically wrong-headed decision that giving money to campaigns is a form of speech. It's a form of free speech. What that means is that any constitutional limitations that apply to speech apply to campaign contributions and expenditures. They are treated the same way as purported limitations, supposed limitations on campaign finance are treated the same way as limitations on what books you can read, what movies you can see, what books you can buy, what movies you can make. Okay, that's somewhat counterintuitive. We tend to think of rights as something invoked to protect endangered or vulnerable populations. Not so much with the right to free speech when that right is the right to donate money to campaigns. The corollary to that, of course, is that people who are not running or donating don't have rights. There is no such thing in our constitutional law about a right to a fair and free election. You can't discriminate on the basis of race or gender or something like that. But in terms of finances, there is no right in the Constitution for people who are only capable of small donations to be treated any differently from people who are capable of big donations or expenditures. Okay, the other thing that I have to point out quickly is any limitations emanating from the state government in Oregon must conform not only to the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, but also to Article 1, Section 8, the free speech guarantee of the Oregon Constitution. First Amendment establishes a protected scope of free speech into which government cannot intrude, with which government cannot interfere. That establishes a minimum, a floor, beneath which government can't fall in terms of regulating speech. It does not establish a ceiling. So a state under its own constitution can grant to its citizens more rights, or additional rights for that matter, than the minimum required by the United States Constitution. And any action by the state has to conform, as I said, to both of those constitutional limitations. Now, as it happens, Oregon has, the Oregon courts have interpreted the Oregon Free Speech Guarantee as much more robust than the First Amendment. So Oregon residents have more free speech rights than the minimum guaranteed by the First Amendment. Okay, and again, to remind you, that includes the free speech. For those of you listening in the radio, I say that with air quotes. Also, for those of you listening on the radio, whenever I listen on the radio, I would like to get a better picture of what's going on. So for those of you who are listening, I should mention that I'm 35 years old, 6'2", 190 pounds, full head of wavy blonde hair. I don't know why those of you listening to the radio, I don't know why they're laughing at that. Anyway, so I'll begin with federal law, but in fact, when we're talking about state regulation, the real, the rubber meets the road, as they say, in terms of the Oregon Constitution. Under federal law, the government can impose limits on campaign contributions, that is, donations to a campaign by an individual. To someone else's campaign by an individual or a group, because the United States Supreme Court says that the nation, the public, has an important, significant interest in preventing corruption, bribery, or the appearance of corruption or bribery. The federal government, however, under the First Amendment, cannot limit a campaign, a candidate's own expenditures on his or her own behalf. For the United States, for the United States Supreme Court, that's a much more central free speech right than donating money to someone else. And furthermore, you can't. You can't bribe yourself. There's not going to be an appearance of corruption, of being susceptible to undue influence from a special interest when the special interest is yourself. Giving someone money, in other words, is not as, under the federal constitution, is not as close to core free speech as spending your own money or speaking for yourself. Now, Oregon law, which is what would apply to state attempts to regulate campaign finance, is different. Oregon, for example, doesn't balance the core or peripheral nature of the free speech involved against the significance or compellingness of the state's interest. To put it very simplistically, in Oregon, the government cannot regulate speech at all. The government can regulate harm that is caused by speech when and if it is caused by speech. But Oregon, unlike under the First Amendment, cannot presume that certain kinds of speech will always have these negative secondary effects and ban or regulate the speech on that ground. Okay, so for example, in Oregon, the legislature cannot pass a statute zoning out adult entertainment on the ground that adult entertainment always leads to, or presumptively leads to, lowered property values, increase in crime, and a general degeneration of the neighborhood. However, they can pass a statute saying any entertainment venue that causes an increase in crime or other specifiable harms can be fined, can lose its license, et cetera, when that happens. Okay, so it's an entirely different form of constitutional analysis. And that doesn't apply intuitively to campaign finance reform, but it does apply. It does apply. And in accord with its more robust interpretation of free speech guarantees, in Oregon, as the prior speaker mentioned, there are no limitations on campaign expenditures or on campaign contributions. That's been established in a couple of cases, one of them in 1999, one of them in 2009, Vannetta versus Kiesling and Vannetta versus Oregon. Oregon campaign, what's the name of the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. Oregon court says there's really no significant difference between a contribution and an expenditure. Both are fully protected. The state can't limit either. Now, there are some exceptions. For example, the state can pass laws prohibiting bribery, out-and-out bribery, where there is a quid pro quo between a donor and a candidate. The state can require disclosure, it can and does require disclosure of contributions and expenditures. That information, when I ran, you had to go to the Secretary of State's office and get it. Now it's all online. You can get it online. The theory from the court being that transparency of this sort will serve as a political curb on the influence of special interests. If the public knows that a candidate is getting money from an individual or group with special interests, the Home Builders Association, the Chamber of Commerce, public employee unions, schools, that will be a sufficient disincentive, and it will have necessary and profound impact on how people are going to vote. I personally think that's quite naive. And in practice, that turns out to be quite naive. First of all, nobody ever checks. Every once in a while, the Oregonian or the local newspapers will run an article, usually after one of the periodic campaign C&E forms, contribution and expenditure forms, are due at various stages of a campaign. And usually immediately after one of those deadlines, the newspapers will run a one-day below the fold or in the second section report on who's giving money to whom. And as far as anyone's been able to tell, that doesn't really do much good. It operates more as gossip than as a political disincentive or incentive. Okay, so that's the constitutional framework in Oregon. I have to say that if we're talking about federal regulation of campaign finance, the Oregon Constitution has no bearing. The Oregon state law cannot constrain the acts of the federal government. Whoever's next, thank you.
Hi, everyone. Kristen Eberhard with Sightline Institute. Thanks for having me here today to talk about a topic dear to my heart. Hopefully will soon be dear to all of yours. I have exciting news that despite all of the constitutional constraints that we just heard about, there are still things within those constraints that we can do to lessen the impact of money in politics. So I'm going to tell you today about two cities right here in the Northwest that are doing some things to lessen the impact of money. So Seattle has a first-of-its-kind democracy vouchers program that they have up and running. They ran their first election in 2017. And the city of Portland, Oregon is in the process of implementing a public match program that's based on other cities that have run successful public match programs. So the idea of these kind of campaign finance reforms is to change who can run for office. So you don't have to be a lawyer married to a doctor with an out-of-state father who is a lawyer and an out-of-state brother-in-law who is a businessman. Just anybody could run. And to change how they run. So right now, people spend most of their time collecting money, which means they're spending most of their time talking to people who have money. And if you don't have to do that, then maybe you can spend more of your time talking to just regular people in your neighborhood. And then the third thing we hope it will change is what people focus on once they're in office. So if you've spent all of your time talking to people with money, you just start to think about the issues that people with money think about. Whereas if you're spending most of your time at city halls talking to people about what's happening in their daily lives, once you get into office, you're just going to be more attuned to those regular people. So that's the idea of these programs that I'm going to tell you about. So Seattle, in 2015, voters overwhelmingly passed Initiative 122, the Honest Election Seattle Act. So it passed by 68% of the vote, which is, in these polarized days, that's a huge accomplishment. And the idea of the program was that every Seattle resident would get four $25 vouchers in the mail before the election, and that they could take those, that was money that they could give to any candidate who had qualified to be a small donor candidate. And to be a small donor candidate, candidates had to agree to a certain rules of the road. So they couldn't take big money. They couldn't take donations over $250. They couldn't spend more than $150,000 total for a district candidate, or $300,000 for an at-large council candidate, or $800,000 for the mayor. So they had a cap on their total amount of money. And they could not benefit from independent expenditures, which is a way that right now candidates, you know, you have a certain amount of money that you run, but then there's another pot of money that's supposedly independent from you that is actually spending on your behalf. So these small donor candidates couldn't benefit from that money. And they had to agree to sort of close scrutiny of their campaign finances. And if anything was wrong, they were subject to tough penalties, including prison time, to make sure that people were abiding by the rules. So that voters voted on that in 2015. The agency went through a lot of process and actually implemented it in 2017. So we actually know how it worked in that election. So there were three offices that were up for election, and Washington has top two elections. So of the six candidates who made it to the general, five of them used the democracy vouchers to get them. So five of them agreed to no more than $250 donations and limits on their spending. So that suggests that voters liked small money candidates. They chose those over the big money candidates. And of those candidates who used the vouchers, they used those vouchers to fund a big part of their campaign. Up to 85% of their money came from the vouchers. So they were really out there collecting those vouchers. And in the most competitive race, both of the candidates who were voucher candidates both reached the maximum number of vouchers they could receive, which was $300,000. So did it actually change things? Well, what we can see from the numbers is that it tripled the number of Seattleites who were donors. So that means that, you know, when you're, you know, looking out at people and saying who's going to participate in the civic process, the vouchers tripled the number of people who felt that they could participate by giving somebody a voucher. That donor base was much more diverse. It was much more geographically dispersed. So what we see under our system now is that donors tend to live in certain neighborhoods. They tend to live in the more wealthy neighborhoods. And in Seattle, that was not true anymore. People came from more neighborhoods. They were more likely to be under 35, and they were more likely to be women. So it did have a big effect on who was participating in the civic process. And it also lowered, it halved the average average amount of donations. So people were definitely operating on smaller money. So that was a big success in Seattle. They're continuing to refine the program, and we'll run the next election on it in this upcoming year, 2019. So let me tell you about Portland. Portland City Council passed an ordinance in 2016 implementing the open and accountable Portland elections. And right now there's an independent board that is working on implementing that. But the basic rules of the road are that it's somewhat similar. You have to opt in to not take big money. You can't take money over $250 per person. You can't raise more than $550,000 if you're a city council candidate, not more than $950,000 if you're a mayor. And if you meet those expectations, then any donation that you get from somebody, a $5, $10 donation, so one of the people that Charlie talked about who was saying, you know, in her neighborhood, maybe people can give $5 or $10, that gets matched 6-1. So that becomes actually a more substantial donation, one that you could maybe really run a campaign on. So one important thing to note here is, so both Seattle and Portland, you have to agree to no more than $250 donations, but there is a big difference that Oregon state law makes. In Washington, you can have contribution limits. So if you're not a small donor candidate, you still can't take a check more than $500. So it makes it much easier to make that call to be a small donor candidate, because you're like, well, 250 versus my, you know, somebody running against me is going to get $500 checks. Like, I think I can make that balance. In Portland, of course, you can get unlimited checks. You can get, your competitor could get six-figure checks. So it makes it a little bit harder to balance the program out. But nonetheless, we are going to see that election running in 2020, and we will then be able to say more about how it, if it really changed who participates in the civic process and who runs. Our hope is that these programs will succeed here in the Northwest, and that we'll then see them spread to the state level and to the national level, which will change maybe who is running and how they're running in other elections too. Thank you.
Thank you for having me here. My name is Robin Quirk. Does it sound good like this? I'm a researcher at a local nonprofit, Policy Interactive Research. One of our primary objectives at Policy Interactive is to identify common ground among Oregonians on topics of societal concern, topics often perceived as polarizing. Every year we test voter support on several policy issues, for example, greenhouse gas reduction, tax revenue allocation, health care, housing for the unhoused, transportation, education priorities, et cetera. So we don't aim to persuade voters. We look for what constituents want so we know which policies to put our energy and resources into. One policy issue we've tested for many years is public opinion on campaign finance reform. And this is a topic for which we've consistently found bipartisan support. In a recent survey we ran, we found that more than 80% of the voting public agrees that political campaign funding and spending is unfair. And today I'm going to share with you all additional data relating to campaign finance reform from two Oregon public opinion surveys we recently conducted, one in December of 2017 and one in December of 2018. So I don't have time today to adequately describe our survey methodology. But it's important for y'all to know that these two samples consisted of likely Oregon voters, and both samples align with the Oregon Secretary of State's demographic statistics on who voted in 2016 and 2018. And that doesn't mean we don't care about people who can't or don't vote. It just means we might misread voter support if we're asking people who don't vote their opinions on these policy issues. And while these two surveys are both opt-in online surveys, we've tested, retested, and confirmed that random digit dial and opt-in online survey responses do not statistically vary. Additionally, last month, Pew Research Center reported that the telephone survey response rate for their 2018 surveys fell to 6%, meaning only 6% of the people they called answered and completed Pew surveys, leading them to now conduct most of their US polling online. For the research results I'm about to share, the full survey and methodology can be found on our website at policyinteractive.org. In December of 2017, we surveyed 547 Oregon likely voters, asking them to choose which of the following two statements they agree with more. Either a federal constitutional amendment should be passed to regulate unlimited money in political campaigns, or B, campaign spending should be constitutionally protected as freedom of speech. 69% chose statement A, to amend the federal constitution to regulate money in political campaigns. We asked that question again in December of 2018, this time with 1,372 Oregon voters. Once again, there was more support for statement A, with 76% expressing a preference to amend the federal constitution to allow regulation over statement B, which stated campaign spending should be constitutionally protected as freedom of speech. So for this December of 2018 survey, we went a little deeper in seeing what voters want when it comes to campaign finance reform. 87% agreed that large political campaign donations buy special access and influence and foster corruption. 89% agreed that political campaign spending should be made as transparent as legally possible to identify the donors. Only 14% opposed limiting contributions to $1,000 to any candidate or measure. And just 8% opposed requiring political messages to identify the four highest dollar donors when total donations exceed $2,500. We also tested the language presently being considered in Senate Joint Resolution 18, asking the respondents if they would vote for a ballot measure to amend Oregon's constitution to allow the state legislature or the people through the initiative process to enact laws limiting or prohibiting contributions to political campaigns. 83% of the respondents answered yes, they would vote to amend Oregon's constitution to allow for this. This 83% support for amending the state constitution is rather unusual. Other surveys we have conducted reveal Oregon voters to be rather resistant to amending the Oregon state constitution, even if they think the policy in question is a good one. So we think this might reflect a lack of familiarity with Oregon's constitution. U.S. state constitutions average 26,000 words, while the Oregon Constitution has over 60,000, having been amended 253 times. The Oregon Constitution is an ever-expanding document, not nearly as static as the U.S. Constitution with its only 27 amendments. My point here being that amending the Oregon State Constitution should not get in the way of supporting policy that would reflect the strong bipartisan support for campaign finance reform. In the world of public opinion surveying, it's encouraging when we find agreement around 70 to 75% on policy issues. So to see bipartisan agreement reach up to 83, 87, 89% is very rare and gives a strong message that Oregon voters want campaign finance reform. Thank you.
Okay, we'll now break for table discussion and formulation of questions. As you're formulating your questions, make sure they don't exceed a minute. We'll see you in 5 minutes.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC, Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Welcome back to the March 8th, 2019 program. It's time for campaign finance reform. Before we proceed, I'd like to recognize our gold sponsors, Arriving by Bike, Gatos Churnside and Balthrop PC, Dr. Sandy Ibarra, Hearing Associates, Evans, Elder, Brown, and Subert. Special thanks to our in-kind sponsors, KRVM 91.9 Radio, Dot Dotson's Photography, PacInfo, and Simplified Computing, LLC. And thank you also to John Highland Construction for hosting this week's section of Oh, the Places You Can Go, a course for teachers who want to learn more about the local economy and the work it offers. City Club partners in this effort with the Eugene and Springfield Chambers, the Lane Workforce Partnership, Lane Education Service District, and thanks to Diamond Parking, who solved the problem. And now we'll proceed to questions. I remind you, you have a minute before the bell. David?
Thank you, David Fidanke, City Club member since the beginning. I have a question kind of in two parts for Kristen Eberhard and David Schumann. The first part for Kristen, and both parts of it relate to how the U.S. Constitution has been interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court. Kristen, when you were talking about the Seattle public financing system, you said one of the conditions for candidates to participate is to agree not to benefit from independent expenditures. But as I understand it, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that under the First Amendment, government cannot limit in the actions of independent expenditure entities, political committees and others. So how can that be enforced in Seattle? And let me. And then my question for Professor Schumann is, given the way the U.S. Supreme Court has been going generally, isn't it more likely that we're unable to see significant reforms that would fly past the U.S. Supreme Court?
So Seattle conditions your ability to benefit from this Seattle-based program. So it's not that you can never benefit from independent expenditures, it's that if you do, then you can no longer get the vouchers. So it's not in violation of the Supreme Court, it's just saying, hey, we have this program here, this is the condition that you can choose not to, or you can choose to participate.
David Schumann, that's correct. I don't think there's any constitutional prohibition of voluntarily limiting from whom or you're going to accept contributions or how many of them you are going to accept. I don't have any faith whatsoever in the possibility of the current United States Supreme Court increasing the ability of government to limit campaign finance contributions and expenditures, and in fact, I would not be surprised to see them go the other direction, so that there would be no limits on either contributions or expenditures.
Yeah, I'm Jack Dresser. I was wondering if any or all of you have given thought to bypass mechanisms around the Citizens United nonsense. And I'm wondering, I'm a psychologist, so I like specific behavioral models and examples. So I'm asking if any of you know how Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar managed to prevail against massive financial opposition. And also looking at other countries as models, that where indigenous people have been fighting for decades against colonial neoliberal money. And I'm thinking of Uruguay specifically, where actual poor people get elected, who care about poor people. Venezuela, Bolivia, Chile in 73-70, and so forth. So it is possible, and how do they do it?
Is this addressed to any particular person, Jack?
Yeah, any of them, yeah. Okay. Have you given thought to this looked at these models?
Thank
you.
This is Charlie Fisher. I think, I guess my response would be, in the current Citizens United regime, the best path forward is, rather than limiting spending, lifting up the voices of small donors and regular people through public financing. And so, at least from our perspective, the way to respond to that is by giving access to public money to be able to run a viable campaign to regular people who may not have connections to wealthy interests, but have people behind them and can turn those small donors into big donors through public financing. And then when it comes to independent expenditures, again, we're in an unfortunate situation right now where there's not much we can do legally. However, there's been success in transparency requirements for independent expenditures. So for example, and I don't know the exact details of this, but in California, they have requirements that independent expenditures list the top donors to an ad, say. And there's one particular example where Chevron was attempting to pass a ballot measure that would have benefited them. And they were essentially the only donor on the yes side. And it was voted down overwhelmingly. And a lot of people point to the fact that all of the ads required the donor to be listed on the ad and said, funded by Chevron. And so when you have that transparency right in the ad, unfortunately, it doesn't do everything because we can't limit the spending in the first place, but it gives people enough information that they can make a more informed decision about where the ads are coming from and make their decisions based on that.
Scott Coltrane, City Club member for 1 year, and my question is for Kristen Eberhard. I didn't follow quite the Seattle example you were talking about. You were talking about six candidates, one who opted out. Were these the winners? Can you just describe a little bit more about how many people opted out and what the impact was and how you thought it influenced the election?
So of the six people who made it to the general, so in the primaries there were 20-odd people, and about eight of the people in the primaries opted into the program. And of the six people who made it to the general, five of them were Democracy Voucher candidates.
Paul Thompson, the City Club member for some time. In the case of the Portland situation, where you have the 6-to-1 matching, and Seattle, where you have the $25 vouchers, where does that money come from to finance that? And a corollary to it is, what city services are not being provided because they have funneled the money in that direction?
So Seattle had a small increase in their property tax to pay for the program. It's 2 cents per $1,000 of valuation. So for a $400,000 house, it adds up to less than $8 a year of property tax, and that funds the whole program. In Portland, it will come out of the general fund. It's about $1 million a year, which sounds like big money to you and me probably, but it's a fraction of a percent of the city's overall budget. And the idea is, like, yes, the city is spending money on this, but if it means that you get better governance, it will pay itself back.
And I think to add to that, there's actually evidence that at the state level, public financing programs pay for themselves. And what I mean by that is Maine and Connecticut are two states that kind of have the most robust and highly utilized public financing programs for state legislative and statewide races. And both have examples of the legislature trying for years to reform corporate giveaways or high-income tax deductions. And the first legislative session after candidates were elected using this clean elections program they were miraculously able to reform those programs and brought in, you know, multiple times more than the program cost itself. So I think the idea is a democracy that is more representative will mean better decisions, and oftentimes that means reallocating tax dollars in a more rational basis than they are currently.
Oh, I'm John Ag, City Club member for quite a few years. The question I have concerns, what do you think can be learned from the political finance rules applying in other democracies, let's say Canada and New Zealand, the Scandinavian countries, and how would the United States fare under some of these rules, for particularly fare for the better?
Did you stump the panel?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an expert on other countries' finance, but I mean, it's just everything is different. Right. So, I mean, I just know I did work on a campaign recently in British Columbia, and the entire campaign is completely publicly financed. So the yes and the no side had the same amount of money. It was a pretty small amount of money compared to what we spend here. So it was just like a whole different world. And that's just the one example I know of. I'm not an expert on other places.
Yeah, I'm Fred Roberts, one-year member. This is a kind of a historical question. Why is Oregon one of the only five states not to limit? I mean, historically, why are we in that situation? It seems kind of anomalous. And secondly, given that the other 45 states have limits, do you have any sense of how did the others impose those limits? I mean, how many of them were through legislative? How many were through other means? Thank you.
Well, just to address the first part of that question, why is Oregon the way it is? Well, things are different here. No, when the Oregon Supreme Courts were most vigorously interpreting Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, they certainly didn't have in mind campaign finance as an issue. It wasn't that big of an issue then, and they looked at the particular history of Oregon at the time the Constitution was drafted. They looked at the language of the Constitution, which is very broad. Legislature shall pass no law interfering with the right to speak, write, or print freely on anything whatsoever. And I think other state Supreme Courts just tend to follow in lockstep with the kind of analysis that they get out of the United States Supreme Court, and it makes sense. There's a body of existing case law out there. You can have to do less work if you're either an attorney who's making an argument or a court that's trying to interpret a provision in the Constitution.
I'm going to ask Justice Schumann to stand up once again in a moment. We have three measures in the legislature this term, this session, to limit campaign finance referral to the people by passing a constitutional amendment. The distinguishing features that are really at the forefront is whether we amend Article 1 of the Constitution, which has to do with freedom of speech and which has been the tripwire from the Supreme Court consistently, or Article 2, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, which has to do with the running of elections and the electoral process. And that's a decision which the legislature has to make, and it's been discussed back and forth which one we should go for. And the tendency is to go for Article 2, because otherwise it will be opposed by, I understand, the American Civil Liberties Union. So I almost want to ask Dave Fedenke this question too, but that's the issue. Which one, David Schumann, would you recommend the legislature amend?
Well, I don't want to sort of get in the business of saying which one I would recommend. I would point out that a lot of the money that comes in defending Article 1, Section 8, as it currently exists, comes from booksellers, libraries, film distributors, people like that. It is difficult. It is difficult to amend a free speech provision. It's a much higher profile part of the Constitution than the other one. So it would, I think, be more difficult to do politically. On the other hand, if you amend the was Article 2, then you have a situation in which Article 2 appears to conflict with Article 1, Section 8, and unless there is language in the other one that says notwithstanding anything else in the Constitution, blah 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 blah, then you get into sort of difficult judicial issues. Which one of those wins? Well, some people will argue that the later and more specific governs over the earlier and more general. Well, that's true of statutes. We're not sure if that's true of constitutional amendments. And in fact, there's a strong argument to be made, since constitutions are, after all, constitutive, that it is the earlier and more general that should prevail over piecemeal attempts to amend things. So there's pluses and minuses on both sides. And I don't know, first of all, I don't know if it would make a lot of difference one way or another. But I couldn't tell you which one would be most politically viable. I know that since they are amendments to the Constitution, neither one of them could be unconstitutional.
I'm going to have to interrupt. We've run out of time. Before we thank our speakers, I'd like to talk to you about next week's program, From Barton Grover to Bethany Grace, Navigating and Studying Gender Transition. Bethany Grace Howell, who is a PhD candidate and a local comedian, very funny, will be here to talk about her life and her transition from a man to a woman and the study she has done of the transgender community around the country. More details about this and other programs at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now, let's thank our speakers, Charlie Fisher, David Schumann, Kristen Eberhard, and Robin Quirk. Thank you, and I look forward to seeing you next week.